My name is Mary Witkowski, and I'm doing an oral history interview with Maestro Gustav Meyer. The date is February 28, 2007. And we're just sitting here, we're talking about 35 years that he's spent with the Greater Bridgeport Symphony Orchestra. And he's sitting here in the boardroom of the Bridgeport Public Library. Thank you for coming here, Gustav.
You're welcome.
When did you start at the Symphony Orchestra?
It actually started, five years before.
5 years before?
When I became music director.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize that you were.
Oh, yes.
I thought you were originally the music director. Well, let's start at the very beginning. What year were you born?
1929.
And where were you born?
In Switzerland.
Can you tell me a little bit, just we'll go for a little bit, and ask about your life in Switzerland and where you lived. And
blue-collar family, very happy childhood, basically. My parents were fine. My father was gone a lot. And then, of course, the war came, interrupted things, and we didn't suffer by no means like the Germans or the French or Italian or American or whatever, English, Russians. But it was a question of living very close to the border. We were about 10 miles, maybe 8 miles from the Rhine, from the border, which is, of course, borders on Germany. And we were neurotically fearful that Hitler would come in, because in 1914 he went behind the French lines, going through Belgium, and that was a very, very easy way to do it. They didn't have to confront the French directly, so they went behind, and we were sure that this time it was going to go through Switzerland. And Hitler was very clever. He thought nobody would expect him to go the same way twice, but he did, which was good for us because we could keep neutral. But we were still always fearful that at the end, the last, when things went badly, we thought maybe he wanted to use Switzerland as a sort of either blackmail kind of things, having the top people in there. You know, we didn't know. But so we were neurotically fearful. It's the only word I could think of. That's why I wanted to have some funny vignettes.
Mm-hmm.
Parents who didn't know how to handle this. But it was fun, basically.
How many children in your family?
Four. We were four.
So,
yeah.
And what did your mother and father do for a living?
What
did they do for a living?
My father was a blue-collar worker, mechanic. Mechanic.
It
was a huge factory
in
neighboring town. And my mother was a housewife. Yeah.
So were you interested in music as a child?
Yeah, my mother wanted to sing. She sang in a choir, I know. And there's some funny stories about that, which is not now. But and my father played. He was in the cavalry. This was a military unit, and he played the bugle. I mean, attack, retreat, whatever. So he played in the local band. That was all there was.
But did they play musical instruments or?
Yeah. So he played the trumpet. Mm-hmm. Then he played later. He shifted to. Well, brass instruments, but he was. There was a local band actually with three bands and three choirs in that little town. No orchestra. I think nobody had a violin in any house. It's too difficult to learn and too expensive. Pianos too. There were no pianos, so it was basically just wind instruments and clarinets, and so there were bands.
Wow. So did your mother play an instrument? She was in the choir.
No. But she taught me actually the trumpet as a surprise for my mother, for my father when he was in Belgium, I think at the time, or in Finland. And so she thought she would teach me how to play the trumpet, and I was five or six or something like this. And of course it was an incredible experience for my father to hear this little thing. And then she made it possible for me to take out the piano, which of course was really great. Then I began to accompany and play, and I played in the band too, and so there was a nice double kind of thing, and so that worked really well, and lots of family, and very nice, basically.
Your brothers and sisters?
I have one brother and two sisters.
And did they play any instruments?
No.
So it wasn't like
only the first one.
It wasn't like the Von Trapp family or
something? Right,
no,
not at all. Actually, I'm sure that I think they're still a little resentful.
Uh-huh.
My two sisters, yeah.
Oh, really? Are you the oldest?
Yeah,
oh, okay.
Yeah, that's why.
Uh-huh. Yes.
They always get everything.
Yes, I understand
yeah.
that. So you went to conservatory. Where was that?
In Zurich, at 14 and a half. I only had 8 years of school.
Mm-hmm.
Not very much. But we actually, the school system in Switzerland is pretty good. I don't know how it would probably be close to a high school education. Not quite. 8 years of public school is definitely not 12 years, which we have here. But we went to school 5.5 days and much longer hours and no big breaks like we have here. So it added up probably to a similar education. And I was very happy. I was not a particularly good student. I had other interests, and so I was very good with my hands. Mm-hmm. I liked to be mechanic myself. But my real love was painting.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And drawing. But I couldn't have, the only thing which would have worked would have been to go to a college, to an art school, but then my grades weren't good enough because that was really very selective, and I mean, to become a painter was out of question, you know, or anything. But so we were interested in the arts, and so it worked well. And at the conservatory, of course, the war was still going when I went, and there were no musicians basically around. We had in Switzerland lots of musicians left.
Mm-hmm.
There were German brass players, French woodwind players, Russian string players. They were all in Switzerland, and they had to go back to their countries.
And what year would this have been around? Hmm? What year?
It was. They had to go to the war in those kind of countries. And in other words, the orchestras were depleted of players.
Mm-hmm.
And so whether you became a trumpet player or as a pianist, you could go in opera houses. Everything was difficult to fill. Positions were, they were
so
closed in.
So this was during World War II?
Right.
War years?
Yeah, until 45, and then the doors began to open,
uh-huh.
But it took a long time, so it was a fabulous time because you could not find a job.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's zero unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
And this was for everything, for whether you're a musician or a plumber or mechanic or school teacher, you know, you got jobs.
Amazing.
Yeah, that was
a
happy time. It's great when you have options and you can quit anytime you want to.
So when did you went out of Switzerland at one point, right? You left?
Yeah. I had which is of some interest, that I played for a jazz trio. Like, you remember the Andrews Sisters?
Oh, yes.
You do?
Yeah.
There were two boys and a girl.
I'm trying to remember their names.
Yeah.
June?
Well, there was a very famous Swiss trio, just like that.
Uh-huh, right.
Actually, they came to Radio City. They were in New York for 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
They were famous. And I studied with the youngest of the three. They were my age, a little older. And so he asked me at one point, I was 17, whether I would accompany them and go on tour with them. And that was, of course, fabulous to do, although I'm glad there are no recordings, I'm sure.
What was the name of the trio?
Trio Schmid, Geschwister Schmid, which
uh-huh.
is siblings Schmid.
Mm-hmm.
But we toured in 47, 46 even, I think 47, we went already to Vienna and to outside the country.
Did you come to New York then?
No, I left them alone. They came 58 or
mm-hmm.
9 or 60, I don't know. But I accompanied them for a couple of years. And then I had, there was a little bad luck. I got to Vienna and with them, and I got really sick because I got some of this penicillin, which was watered down,
oh, mm-hmm.
you know, from the third man.
Mm-hmm.
I had a terrible cold and so they pumped me full of this penicillin. It was not good, and so I had to go back in the hospital and the mountains, and everything got attacked, the lungs and kidneys. So it was about 2 years. And so that was blocked. And then after that, sort of I had put music in the background a little bit, but then suddenly got the bug again. And I thought, well, I should do something with it. And then I went to the conservatory as a conductor,
mm-hmm.
a student for conducting. And the rest, of course, is I got a job at Zurich Opera House and for a couple of years, and then I went to Tanglewood, and I liked it so much there. I thought, student orchestra was better than Zurich Symphony at the time. So I thought, that's the place I want to stay. And then I married, of course, an American singer. Uh-huh. And so we became here. And she was from New Haven.
Oh.
And then by chance, I got the job at Yale, which was her home turf. So
mm-hmm. And what was the job at Yale?
Assistant professor for conducting mm-hmm. and I taught orchestration, but basically it was a great job.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed there for 20 years maybe.
Mm. Yeah.
And during that time, okay, let's talk about Bridgeport. During that time, I was always, one of the things I got very, very stimulated during my piano days, when I really was working hard on the piano, and my teacher really wanted me to become a pianist because I had very good fingers. They were just going, with, mm-hmm. which was, and he said, you got to do something with those fingers, and I didn't really want to. It was too hard work. I mean, you have to really work very hard. Not just if the fingers go, you don't have to do too many exercises, but the repertory, to memorize the repertory, and it's so huge, and mm-hmm. I didn't want to do it. So, but one person who stimulated me was José Iturbi.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came to Yale, and I had forgotten about Iturbi. And so I was suddenly, Lou Standish was his name, he suddenly called me out of the blue and he said, you know, he went everywhere. He went to New York, he came to New Haven, he had come to some of the concerts there, and see me conduct. He said, you know, I think you really would be the right person for the Bridgeport Symphony. I said, well, that's very nice. What? How long? This would have been perfect. I mean, it was five concerts and maybe pop concerts or two. And the Yale job was not that mm-hmm. time-consuming. I could definitely do it. And so I said, okay, we'll consider you as one of the three candidates. And there was José Serrebrier, who has made quite a career. And what was the other one? La Selva, I think, who also has made I'm quite sure it was him, a career in opera in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were the three finalists. And after the season was over, the board decided that they would offer me the job. So it was great, and we began to make some plans. And then I was called by Lou Standish, just said, I'm sorry, we had to withdraw our offer. And we hadn't signed a contract. And I said, what happens? Well, we got this call from José Iturbi. And José Iturbi wants to conduct our orchestra. And I said, why would José Iturbi, whose career at that particular point had really fizzled out, because people held it against him to appear with Esther Williams and Harry James.
He was in all his movies.
Of movies. Right. So he didn't get any more classical concerts. But then he got interested in conducting. Uh-huh. But why the Bridgeport Symphony? And Lou Standish says, because his daughter lives in Fairfield County, and she has children, and he loves his grandchildren. He didn't say he loves his daughter, he loves his grandchildren. So, and see, he said that'd be a wonderful opportunity to go to visit them five times a year. And so, you know, he's a famous name, and we have to go with him. I said, okay, that's fine. I mean, by all means, I'm sorry, but I think it's a good choice, wonderful mm-hmm. choice, because whether he can conduct or not, I didn't know. But I thought it was a fun link because my mother also adored José Iturbi at this recording. So here I was sacked for José Iturbi. And then I think he stayed there for about 5 or 6 years. And then he quit. And the minute he quit, they called me whether I would be interested now. I said, sure. So if José Iturbi didn't have grandchildren in Fairfield County, then I would have now the 40th anniversary.
Wow.
A world record.
Time.
Yeah. So that's the pre-history with the Bridgeport Symphony.
So actually you were, you didn't actually start conducting the symphony you conducted it before 1972. You started really...
When he starts, 72?
When you were actually first year conducting in Bridgeport, 1972 is what I have.
Okay,
down.
So let me see. 72, really?
Oh, that could be wrong.
No, actually,
according to this timeline, let's see.
No, it must be 72.
72, debuts as music director of the Greater Bridgeport Symphony on October 14th with Robert Schumann's Symphony No. 4 in D minor, William Schumann's New England Triptych, Debussy's Prelude, La Prelude, and Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet.
That's really, I think 72, 5 years earlier would make 68, 67. Yeah, 67, that was, I think I got the air job in 50. In 61 or 2.
You were at Tanglewood 57, 58.
Yes. And then I lived in New York. So I think 1960 I must have gotten the Yale job.
Well, here's something to spark. 1961. What was important about 1961?
1961.
You became a United States citizen.
So
you had been here this long that you decided
1961?
1961.
Yeah, because I did come when I became as a student. I already decided that since my wife was American, just in case I was trying to apply for citizenship. Mm-hmm. So it was so from that point on, I was at 61. Yeah, mm-hmm. It makes sense. So I could, because it takes usually 5 years, or I don't know how many years. So this worked out very, very well. Mm-hmm. But that was a non-event, except to talk about discrimination. The first thing he said, have you been faithful to your wife? Do you have homosexual tendencies? And
this is the person who was
interviewing
you?
For citizenship. That was weird. I remember. I couldn't believe it. So that's, of course, gone, too. All these
hopefully.
Yeah, of course. But it was, this should not go into history there, right? It's just off the record. But anyway, it worked well, and 57, 58, I came, and then went to New York, mm-hmm. and in New York, freelanced. Mm-hmm. I copied music, played in churches, coach singers, and then I got this Yale job. And mm-hmm. the Yale job, of course, worked out because of my Tanglewood connections, mm-hmm. because Adam Copeland, he's in the mm-hmm. pictures there, and also Milton Babbitt, who was then en vogue. He was then fashionable because a 12-tone composer, and they were sort of domineering the creative side of the American music making. Pointillistic kind of thing, you remember, mm-hmm. this like Schoenberg mm-hmm. and Weben, sort of weird kind of things, but they were considered, this is the future. And so I did a piece of his, and we connected, and he had tremendous clout, and together with Copeland, and the Yale job opened. I didn't apply for it. Got a phone call, come, you see.
Beautiful.
And then, of course, then I stayed with Yale.
Mm-hmm.
Which might have been a crossroad, because then I was invited to join the New York Philharmonic by Bernstein.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't go because I had was only 1 year at Yale, and or maybe 2 years, I don't remember. And I had a contract, and I thought, I can't just walk out. I mean, and Bernstein said, well, it's a great opportunity. And I said, can I come after? And he wanted me to sign a contract for 2 years later.
Wow.
And I said, I can't really do that. And that was the end of it, so I stayed. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, those were regrets, whether people have asked me many times whether that was, because there was a choice then between academia and mm-hmm. and the professional world,
conductor.
Or the real world. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. And I'm not sure. Teaching wasn't, I wasn't as turned on to teaching then mm-hmm. as I became later really involved, and I thought it was really great fun and mm-hmm. enriching and all the good things.
When did you make a choice between becoming just a pianist and a conductor? I mean, where was it?
Well, it was connected with the illness
mm-hmm.
because I couldn't do any physical kind of thing. And even piano playing or trombone playing were physically taxing kind of thing, or playing in the orchestra for an opera for 4 hours, or playing an opera house coaching or practicing. It's a physical thing. So they said, now you should do something. So my father got me actually a job in an office, in his factory, which I liked very much, really liked it. And then I got an offer to play in an opera house as a trumpet player, and also playing the piano. And I left the job after maybe a year, and maybe another year. I forgot sort of how long I was there. I was there long enough to really like it. Mm-hmm. But of course I liked much better than to be back into music. And then I very quickly after I was there one season in that opera house. It was the smallest opera house in Europe. It was in Biel-Bienne, which is a bilingual city. Mm-hmm. They speak French or they speak German. And the opera house seated 300 people. And the pit seated maybe 17 musicians.
Wow.
And so, then Mozart came into play. It was Figaro. Mm. And then I heard Figaro on stage, the finale. I was hooked. I thought, I must not just be in the pit, I must be there, be part of this. Mm. So I went back to school, then in conducting. Mm-hmm. And then I had a job. And then, of course, Ethiopia got involved right after that, which was very strange. And then I went back to Vienna, this time I was a student, I went to the conservatory after the emperor job, after 1 year. And then I went to Vienna to study some more. And actually that's when Mehta and Abado were also in the class in Vienna. And I didn't like the teacher at all. And the class was huge. There were about 20 students or more sitting around. And I didn't insist. So I got a job at the Vienna Chamber Opera. It's not Vienna State Opera, Vienna Chamber Opera. And then I went to Tanglewood. What happened then is after Vienna, I got the Zurich job.
Zurich Opera.
Yeah, for 2 years. 57. And I came back. I went to Tanglewood in 57. I came back to Switzerland to do my second year contract at the Zurich Opera. And then I went 58 permanently. And then freelancing 2 years in New York, and then I guess Yale, and then after several years, Bridgeport offer, and then abortive kind of event, and then we connected in 72.
So you took over the orchestra after Jose Turbay,
right.
Conducting it for 4 years, 5 years, I guess.
Something like that. And before Iturbi, they had Pelea, Joel Pelea, who was paralyzed one side.
Hmm.
And he conducted only with one arm. Mm-hmm. And a very good conductor. He was at the Met, and I think he did some couple of really good recordings.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a stroke, and he kept on with the Bridgeport Symphony. It was kind of, I don't know why it came to an end, whether he quit or whether the orchestra decided it's just too much, because it was kind of difficult to watch him, because he would sort of wet his fingers and had to stop conducting and turn the pages.
Uh-huh.
And
you actually saw him conduct it?
He would go and then stop
and
turn the page and then continue. So it was not very stimulating. I didn't, the recordings of course there, it didn't matter at all.
I think he was with them for a long time.
He was.
Now, was he with them because the Bridgeport Symphony Orchestra was originally the Works Progress WPA Symphony Orchestra.
Oh, really?
Yes, it was part of the, that's how it began. It was part of the Works Progress Administration.
Oh, I see.
And in 1941 it became the Bridgeport Symphony Orchestra. So I think he was there from early on.
Yeah.
So you started. Let's get to where you started.
Yeah. Well, and those
so you began, and the symphony was already at the Klein, right? Auditorium.
Yeah. And then it.
And what did you think when you arrived? And you'd already seen the symphony in the Klein Auditorium, but what did you think of the Klein Auditorium at that point?
I liked it then too. It was a certain intimacy. Woolsey Hall, in
New Haven
was okay, but it was sort of like a box. Mm-hmm. Like more, there's that sort of a charm, sort of a little old-fashioned European charm, I thought.
Mm-hmm. Woolsey Hall.
The Woolsey Hall didn't.
That no, was, it didn't.
No, that was more like a shoebox with, mm-hmm. with yeah. Also very attractive, mm-hmm. obviously, but and much larger, 2,500, and this is 1,600 or 500. Mm-hmm. And I liked the people from the very beginning. They were different. Of course, I liked Henry Dupont at that point.
Mm-hmm.
He was also very involved in getting me the job, and we became really, of course, acquainted.
Mm-hmm.
And he was wonderful to have. He was very supportive, and there were no problems, financial problems. He would always be so supportive that he couldn't be in the red.
Mm-hmm.
The tragic accident, of course, did change things. Right? You know about that, right? Well, I think he was. I don't know. He was president at the time, and
president of the symphony.
Symphony.
Henry Dupont.
The fourth or the third, mm-hmm. or I don't know which one. Mm-hmm. And then his father-in-law, and he went on a flight, airplane, and apparently what happened is that Henry got out of the plane, stood on the wing. It's sort of, it's one of those planes, you had to step on the wing and go back. His father-in-law pushed the throttle somehow, and the plane began to turn around in a circle. And then they threw him off, of course, and then he cracked his skull and he died.
Uh-huh.
And I remember that there was a lot of bad stories about it, but it was just a freak accident,
yeah.
That's all it was.
The daredevil,
yeah,
it sounds like to me.
No, it was not even daredevil.
No.
It was just a normal exit. You had to
to
step on the wings and then.
Oh,
yeah.
I see. Oh, I thought he was out on the plane while it was flying.
No. He's a very shy person. Oh, that's not. That would have been.
We'll erase that from the story.
Right.
That wasn't true.
No, he was a very sweet guy, and his wife too. They were big supporters. Them and then Mrs. Dupont, later the widow, she was very supportive of the symphony too, and. But then she had her own life after a while,
mm-hmm.
and she occasionally comes to still see us. I'm sure she's still supportive of the symphony,
mm-hmm.
and that was sort of a tragedy, I thought. But then we had lots of changes, but the steady thing was, of course, Bob Tilley.
Mm-hmm. Bob Tilley.
He was either board member or he was the chairman of the board.
Uh-huh.
And he was, as you know, was a wonderful negotiator who would rise to be always to keep things calm, because it can get very, very, very troublesome within a symphony orchestra with the artistic side, and the orchestra with their wishes, and the audience with their wishes,
mm-hmm.
and the board with their wishes. So it's a complicated kind of thing. I mean, I'm sure it's the library has equal different things. Which
so when you came, I mean, I'm not sure how this works, but you have the symphony orchestra. Do you get to hire and fire people as part of the orchestra itself?
That's one of the things you have to do,
uh-huh.
but of course you try to avoid that, because
mm-hmm.
once you, very often a conductor comes in and they clean up the orchestra,
mm-hmm.
which is a big problem. One shouldn't do that, because it makes the orchestra very, very insecure, and
mm-hmm.
because it's not their livelihood alone, but it's
mm-hmm.
part of their livelihood, and prestige too, and known in the community, and suddenly somebody would be told you can't play, leave. That was not a good, would not have been a good thing, and I never did that. What did happen, there were occasionally things, occasionally a member who we got in trouble with, or who maybe really should have retired, and then the delicate process
mm-hmm.
begins, how to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some unpleasant moments,
mm-hmm.
But basically you have a committee and you have guidelines by which you go. It's just what we talked
mm-hmm.
about, employment. You have to express your concern and talk to that person and say, can you improve? And the whole cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to re-audition, and then sometimes when they're exposed to that, they just quit on their own. Mm-hmm. But it's a delicate thing. You never had to do this. There was a turnover, and then we had new auditions. But I never auditioned by myself. There was always a committee which gets together, mm-hmm. which is chosen based on who auditions. Mm-hmm. It's a woodwind player and a couple of woodwind players, principals who come, strings, some string players, and a little bit of a mixture, I think, which is good.
What were your first reactions when you took over this symphony? I mean, was there anything that, like, having been had this, you know, great past at Yale and in Europe, what kind of a transition did you take over Bridgeport?
It didn't feel strange. Mm-hmm. Of course, there was the thing where the concert is totally identical with the concert in Europe. It's mm-hmm. the same piece, the same tales, mm-hmm. same musicians playing the same instrument, the same sound, the same reaction of the audience, basically. So that's the same. It's just if you guest conduct any place, you don't really get to know the audience. They come maybe backstage, some people, and want to shake hands or want to be critical or whatever. But here in America, of course, you have to become part a little bit of the community. So there's some meetings, some parties, mm-hmm. some backstage events. Things which Berenboim in Chicago didn't want to do anymore. So mm-hmm. he said, I don't want to raise money, although yeah, I never raised money. But men go out and say, would you consider giving $20,000 or something? I never had to do this. And that, but I think the way it usually works is that socially you get together with someone who might be interested and then mm-hmm. try to just be social. Right. With that particular person and give this person, maybe explain to this person what it would mean if he would do a Mahler symphony, mm-hmm. which costs another $15,000 because there's so many more instruments. Mm-hmm. And so maybe you could talk about that, or you could talk, oh, I wish we could have Beverly Sills. And so somebody came actually up and then paid for Beverly Sills fee, which was five times bigger than the other fees.
Wow.
Or Isaac Stern the same, mm-hmm. or who else was there? A big name, Beverly Sills, and there was somebody else.
I know that they've had guest conductors over the years.
Well,
are you usually there when they have a guest conductor?
No. No. But I think there was another soloist who again was paid for by somebody who got interested and they want to make me a party at their house afterwards. Mm-hmm. But if you pay $10,000 to get a famous artist, when we only spend $2,000 for a soloist, mm-hmm. that makes a big difference. And of course, we would fill the hall, and then people would subscribe for the mm-hmm. whole season because the subscribers would get first choice.
Mm-hmm.
And so people who wanted to hear Beverly Sills would subscribe.
Mm-hmm.
They may not have come to any other concert, but it didn't matter. They bought the tickets.
Well, it's like any job where you have to, like even in art, where you have to suggest things to the museum.
Right,
and
right,
some people are going to like music or certain.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, speaking of all the people that came to play at the Klein under your direction, can you just talk about a few memorable events maybe that somebody that really stands out?
And
it could be something amusing too. I love great stories.
It's
like a theater going to the symphony
right.
because anything could happen on that stage.
Yeah,
you know?
So things did happen. I remember a clarinetist who fainted, and then when I was trying to give him a cue, he disappeared behind his music stand. He was just gone.
Mm-hmm.
That was interesting.
Mm.
That was one of the scary moments. Another time, there was an accident, and three principal players came from New York, and they were all not there, and they had the parts with them, and the concert, the show had to go on. And those were very, very difficult situations where you give them something to read from the score, you know, a score which has all the instruments listed, it's mm-hmm. nearly, it's complicated. Or people say, well, I know the solos by heart, not the tutti's. I mean, when everybody plays, I don't know, I don't pay attention too much, but the solos, I know, I think I can sort of do that. So we sort of managed, but it was very hairy, and they eventually came in. an hour late for the second half. But it was very, and actually, people who, missing people, there were not too many, or someone who, it was remarkable. I don't have many stories where things went wrong, mm-hmm. really wrong. I think we never canceled the concert.
Mm.
I'm trying to think. There were some funny things happening with the soloists occasionally, like this one lady who went off stage between the numbers and the side wings. There was no shell yet, mm-hmm. so you could see from the orchestra. You could see the mm-hmm. things were like this. You could see, and she lifted her dress and thrust the towel in my hands and said, "Dry my back." The whole orchestra was watching. At least there were people who said.
I'm sure that happens. It's got to be very warm up there in the state.
Or Benny Goodman, when he had, he said, "Oh, wait a second, and you go in and have a little scotch." And
who was that?
Benny Goodman.
Oh, Benny Goodman.
Yeah, Benny Goodman.
Did he play
quiet.
Did he?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And also I thought it was very funny that he would play the Weber concertino, I think it was a short classical piece, mm-hmm. By heart, and then he played a medley of his own music, and he had this huge score which he needed.
You have to be ready for anything.
Right.
Like
I thought that was very funny.
What about Peter Nero? Do you remember Peter Nero?
No, see, I wasn't there.
You weren't there, okay.
He would play by himself, uh-huh. and conduct and play the piano, I think, right?
Oh, okay.
He plays the piano too, right?
Yes, that's what I knew.
Yeah, and conduct,
yeah.
He was a pro, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's always what people want, the full house, and that's the biggest problem right now with orchestras all over the country. But the seniors are in Florida, and mm-hmm. in Palm Springs, and I don't know where, but definitely not in the cold here, and the younger generation is not coming. And it has to do with education, clearly. Mm-hmm. With Michigan had, for instance, public school system. Every school had an orchestra and a band mm-hmm. and a chorus. Three, unbelievable. From the very beginning. Now they cut down, the first thing they throw out are
music
or
right.
arts, or they just stick to math, which is, it's fine. But that has an effect. But I think they're really working on it to find ways of attracting the younger people,
mm-hmm.
but with the news at the television, it's just not very good what you see on television. It's a little better in Europe. I mean, you still can get full symphony concert quite often.
Mm-hmm.
You turn on a channel, there's the whole thing, as boring mm-hmm. as it may seem to look at. So
that's one of the things you've noticed over the years, is the dwindling audiences in the symphony.
It's not a catastrophe yet, but it could, unless we do something. And I don't know exactly what. But of course, the American Symphony Orchestra League, which is the sort of the umbrella organization for all orchestras, they discuss this all the time. What can we do?
Mm-hmm.
And this multimedia is involved, paintings behind the orchestra. Dancers in front of the orchestra. There are new things coming in now.
So it's interesting. When did you sort of start noticing a demise in the audience?
It happens very subtly. I mean, uh-huh. in a subtle way. Someone has regularly subscribed, suddenly is no more subscribing.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's always followed through. And you call and it says, the telephone number has been changed,
mm-hmm.
and the area code, of course, is Florida or something. And well, there we go. And we also, of course, someone like Bernstein is no more around, who was a symbolic figure,
mm-hmm.
West Side Story and Symphony and New York. He was sort of a Renaissance man who could do everything, mm-hmm. beautiful pianist. And we don't have a composer now who catches
mm-hmm.
the audience. I mean, we don't whistle any tunes of any contemporary composer. They're very good composers now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Adams or Philip Glass or John Adams or Harbison, they're some very good composers. But they don't have necessarily the appeal which Bernstein had.
Mm-hmm.
Or it just takes somebody who, we're all waiting for the next piece.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the connoisseurs, the experts do wait for the next piece of
mm-hmm.
Philip Glass or
right.
John Adams.
Who would you name today that are some of the exciting composers that, you know, the current, I mean, it's interesting because we do rely on the old,
right.
you know, Tchaikovsky,
yeah.
And,
yeah, right.
and they play the same,
right,
everybody
right.
loves those pieces.
Right.
But now, what pieces are we hearing?
Well, Copland, of course, and Gershwin, those were,
right.
they're also gone
right.
now, they're tradition
yeah.
now, and Barber. And then now of course we have people like Bill Balkan,
mm-hmm.
John Harrison, Previn, Arthur Previn actually wrote some music. Yes. So there are many composers. It would be difficult to start
mm-hmm.
listing them without leaving out
mm-hmm.
some. There's some highly talented composers and opera now. Opera is there's really good news.
Gelb
at the Met really wants to bring in new operas,
mm-hmm.
and now they just hired a new director for the City Opera.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether you read the New York Times today.
Mm-hmm.
He comes from Paris, the Paris Opera, which is a huge organization.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, watch it is 10 times larger than the City Opera.
Mm-hmm.
But he also was in Salzburg and a real adventurous kind of director,
mm-hmm.
new production, new things, and Gelb already with you can. Every so often you can go to one of the great movies places in Ann Arbor and they have a live broadcast of an opera.
Hmm.
That's really wonderful. And so they're trying to get new audiences.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy, I'm sure, will do the same thing. So that's good. They have rival.
Mm-hmm.
They're real rivals now.
Right.
And the Metropolitan director doesn't have the reputation of the director of the City Opera, which is number two. So the number one director now is at the number two opera house, even though Gelb is a very good man, there's no question.
Mm-hmm.
So this would be very exciting to watch, you know.
So you were living in New Haven or were you living in?
I lived in New Haven.
And
yeah.
then you moved to Michigan at one
yes,
point?
Yes, yeah.
Around what year was that?
76, I think. But I had a 1 year or 2 years, or 3 years at Eastman.
Oh,
that was just a little while. I didn't like it as much there.
Rochester.
Fabulous school, I mean,
mm-hmm.
wonderful school too. And when Michigan offered a job, I thought I would go. I sort of did
mm-hmm.
maybe Midwest.
That was the Lansing Symphony? Or when
oh, that
did
came
you go
later.
To
that
oh,
came
what
later.
Did you go to Michigan for?
For the university.
Oh, okay.
University. They looked for a new conductor, and it looked just great. That was a nice change. I mean, I still liked Eastman. Eastman was a conservatory, Michigan
mm-hmm.
was a university more.
Mm-hmm.
And but it was much larger. I think there were over 1,000 majors, and Eastman had a smaller pool of students. But it was a great school, Michigan rated right up there with
mm-hmm.
Indiana and Juilliard, of course,
mm-hmm.
Curtis, and they're pretty much in the same pool. So, and then also Midwest was sort of more like Switzerland, inland.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So in Europe, right. in Europe, you're also the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
Switzerland is right in the center.
Plus, they have these nice cold winters.
Well, they don't. I've never seen as much snow
right,
in
yeah.
Switzerland as I've seen in Michigan.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh.
You have to be really close to the Alps if you want snow,
because mm-hmm.
all the clouds come in and get stuck at the Alps, and it's also sunshine. It's terrible, no sun.
So that must be interesting, traveling back and forth from Michigan to this area. You know,
yeah,
you come,
it's always
how
yeah.
many times a year do you come to do?
Well, 4 or 5 times.
Uh-huh.
But I'm now in Peabody, which is great. You know,
oh, okay.
I teach at Hopkins. I mean, it's part of Hopkins is the Peabody Conservatory.
Mm-hmm.
And which is just the greatest job in the world.
That's wonderful. So you would how was it to be traveling
back and forth with you? I do about nine Monday and Tuesdays.
Mm-hmm.
I go in Sunday night, the last plane out, and I'm home for dinner on Tuesday.
Hmm.
And I teach 5 seminars while I'm there, 3 on Monday and 2 on Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
And we just had auditions, the hardest job in the world.
What's that?
the hardest job in the world is to audition.
Oh.
I mean, this, we had sometimes between 50 and 100 applicants, and they send videotapes of their conducting. And then you have to invite 15 for live auditions, and then you pick 3 or 4.
Wow.
And it was very exciting, this last audition. I haven't decided yet. That's why it's on my mind. Who are you going to pick? Who should I pick up, and more who can I reject?
So you always arrived early for the Bridgeport Symphony, like a couple days. You didn't wait till the last minute.
No, well, that's only because of the of Peabody now.
Uh-huh.
Because I take the train. I came in by train last night. I was here at 7:50.
I see.
Yeah, it's great. I love the train line.
Uh-huh. But you don't take the train all the way from Ann Arbor, do you?
No. I was timed it so that I have Monday, Tuesday, Peabody, then Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday here, and then on Monday I go back and have another Monday, Tuesday, and then I go back.
Okay, I was asking you about the change in Bridgeport. After, you know, in the years that you've come here, I saw in the one of the articles that I was reading that you always came in a couple of days earlier, and that you always ate at the Ocean Sea Grill.
Right. And now at Ralph and Rich's, I want no more at Ralph and Rich's because they moved.
Oh yeah.
Yeah,
right,
I'm very unhappy about that.
Uh huh. But you remember coming into the Ocean Sea Grill?
Right, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
That was the place, huh?
That was the place, right. And I was stayed always in Lafayette. But then I think it has changed. I think it's more safe.
Mm-hmm.
It's although just today there were two women orating on the street, talking to themselves, which actually I haven't heard for a while.
Uh-huh.
Sort of like street people probably, or just, so, hey, what's going on? But basically I feel much more comfortable. I'm always unhappy to see another building shacked up, you know what we call it?
Boarded up.
And as a matter of fact, I thought at one point I should move to Bridgeport and live downtown, right on Main Street.
Mm-hmm.
Because there must be great places.
Well, they are redoing that. That's all the boarding up right there on
that's
Main Street
what
right now.
Yes, right.
They're completely. They're opening up these beautiful apartments.
Right.
You can live
right
here.
No, I really believe in downtown.
Uh-huh.
And having been in the countryside, but I love New York for that reason. I mean, it was exciting, and where we live now in Ann Arbor is nearly like a little bit like New York or here. There's an African American family one side and right next to us, and one African American across the street, an Asian and a Mexican.
That's wonderful.
And what else? I mean, it's great.
Right. Where are you in Ann Arbor?
In downtown, right on Fifth Avenue, which goes straight through it towards the railroad station. And it's really great. Nobody bothers each other. Before, we lived in a sort of typical fancy neighborhood with children and country club and we just felt, well, the minute the children were gone, I felt that, no.
Too much,
yeah. We should be living in an atmosphere where professionals are and different.
Right. Yeah. So Bridgeport has went the Ocean Sea Grill and now, yes.
I was sad to see it disappear.
Uh-huh.
And now it's hard to see Ralph move. Yes, the new restaurant is great. But first of all, it's 3 or 4 blocks farther.
Right.
And I don't feel totally comfortable to walk there by myself.
Mm-hmm.
It's because if I come on Tuesday night, and I walk there at 8:30 to have a late dinner, I don't feel totally, and my wife doesn't want me to walk, definitely.
Right.
And to take a cab, I could take a cab, sure. And I also, even the hotel probably could get me there, and I just would have to get back with the car. But that's a little too much, and that was so charming, the old restaurant.
Right, it was right near the hotel. Oh, yes. Well, the old one I've been to, the new one I've been to many times now. Probably more to the new one because it's right across the street from us.
Oh, that's right, that's right.
That makes it easier.
Yeah.
So, it's interesting because living in Michigan and Ann Arbor, and I'm from Detroit, so
right,
so the connections of Bridgeport and Detroit always interest me in terms of the urban, with the symphony in an urban area. Yeah. Do you notice, anything in particular about Bridgeport and being in an urban area?
Well, my wife worked in downtown Detroit, in the Buell Building, you remember the name? With the metal doors, great gale building. Great.
Yeah.
That has changed too. Detroit is changing also. I mean, after the rebellion there,
revitalization?
No,
the riots. The riots. 1968. Eight riots.
I remember a law professor at Wayne with whom Emmy worked. She invited us for dinner late a couple of years later. Jenny's mansion. I mean, unbelievable, gorgeous. And she said, we got it practically for $15,000.
Right, above probably. I know exactly where it is.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think it's getting safer there too. Here I feel things have improved, and the hotel, Ernie Trent does a really good job with the hotel. The rooms are nice now, very nice. Mm-hmm. The new basketball, what is it called, building in downtown?
Oh, the stadium, the arena.
Arena.
Harbor Yard.
Right.
Baseball, yeah.
The basement. So that apparently is very effective. That's good.
Yeah, the competition for symphony is against sports.
Right, of course. Yeah. No, but I feel the hotel people, there's some people who's, I've been there for 10, 15 years. So it's always good to see them.
Mm-hmm.
And they always like to see my face. It feels like home a little bit. And I hate to see people leave when they, especially board members who have to be very dedicated, and then the term comes to an end and they don't come back.
Mm-hmm.
That always hurts my feelings because I think they just put it on that they like the symphony.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But people are just so busy, you know. You can't even blame them because there's so many more things to go to, and then they also, I guess, I don't know what it is. Why they don't have the time anymore. Mm-hmm. I think it's not a question of money for the people to go to concerts, although it's much more expensive to the tickets.
Yeah. I find it interesting that as a young man that you had health problems.
Yeah.
And then you chose more to go into conducting because of that.
Right.
I have seen you conduct.
Yeah.
It seems extremely active.
Yeah,
it seems like a workout.
Yeah, it is a workout. And no, my health is good. I have prostate cancer, but it's the best cancer to have.
Right, but how is it like when you're conducting in the symphony?
Oh, the energy is really great.
Right, that keeps you going. The energy of
I don't know, but I was sort of a food freak. At one point, I realized, did you know Adele Davis? Yeah, Brewer's East.
right.
I was into that for a while. And then I was into macrobiotic diet, and I looked at it, it was not very attractive food. I think I couldn't.
That's why you live in Ann Arbor. They're all into that stuff.
Yeah, they were. But then I began to the leftover of the macrobiotic food actually made me change my eating habits, and I went really for vegetables and fruit much more, then I also take fish oil, all the things which are good for you.
Mm-hmm.
And it has been terrific. I mean, I have absolutely had no health problem at all. So which is great.
But what I was curious about is that when you conduct, it's almost like an exercise
program
watching.
Right.
I mean, you have to really be all over the stage, moving. And
Yeah, but it's strange, but the conductors don't die. You know, they
right.
have, because the exercise is basically around your heart.
Uh-huh.
And it was very funny, about 2 years ago, the medical exam, they said, there's something wrong with your heart, I'm afraid we have to go in there. I think it looks like your arteries are becoming a problem. I said, what? My arteries are a conductor? I mean, so I said, no, I think the test has shown, stress test mm-hmm. has shown that there must be something wrong. So they go, you know, they go from, they put the thing in, and take pictures inside your heart. Mm-hmm. And so afterwards, you stay half a day in the hospital and come out, and then the doctor says, we all look at this together. The high tech pushes it, there it is in your heart. And he looks at it. Those are the cleanest arteries I've ever seen. And I said, well, what about the test? He said, well, the stress test, maybe in 150 or maybe 200 tests, one goes totally wrong and gives us the wrong signals. And I said, why didn't we do it again? He said, well, then we're in the same place. If once it's bad and once it's good, then, you know.
Then do a third one.
Yeah, right. I thought it would be really funny.
Oh, so it is a good workout. That's what I was getting at.
It is
in itself. It's a workout.
Yeah, but it's really,
because the audience, when they watch you, they're in the edge of their seat because it's so, you know, invigorating.
It's terrific. It's a great job to do it. This great music.
Mm-hmm.
And this concert is also with. There's actually not too many really great music. This program by Don Juan is fabulous.
Oh, the
Strauss Don Juan is fantastic, fantastic piece. And the Alborada by Ravel is also a very exciting mm-hmm. piece. And then the Carmen, that's sort of fluffy. And then, of course, his music is a virtuoso kind of. Hollywoodian.
Over the top, sort of.
Shouldn't say Hollywoodian, but it's on the pop side.
Mm-hmm.
But very good. He's a very good composer too.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be fun, all fun.
So every time you conduct, it's because of the pieces that you choose, and you choose mm-hmm. the pieces.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So always choose their pieces. But usually they supply 10 concertos mm-hmm. or 8 concertos, and then we look what we have done and what we think this person would do best.
And as a teacher, you've actually had quite a few students who have gone on to great things,
yeah.
right?
Well, that's always the most important thing, that
mm-hmm.
that they get jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been very lucky. I think it has to do with whom you choose
mm-hmm.
first, because if you choose badly, there's nothing you can do. If you think this person is talented, and then
mm-hmm.
they are talented, but they don't like the work, for instance,
right.
or they... But I think I've done better than the usual people who pick conductors, because more have gotten jobs, and I don't give it all credit because of my teaching. I give it credit of their basic talent. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you have to spot the talent,
mm-hmm.
and in conducting it's very difficult. I mean,
mm-hmm.
the orchestra plays just the same, whether you have somebody in front who doesn't know how to conduct,
mm-hmm.
the orchestra still plays.
Right.
So really, that's what the difficulty
right.
is.
And not to be too critical, I guess,
right?
So that
right.
you grow
yeah.
on your own.
As I say, good conductors get away with murder, you know?
Really?
They do. Oh, yeah,
yeah,
absolutely. Well, actually, this week we have the president is going to conduct.
Oh.
Who has absolutely, he bought 5 minutes of time. Ottavio.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So he's conducting a Mexican kind of a,
mm-hmm.
it's actually French,
mm-hmm.
yeah, it's French, but I think the topic is, I don't know, but and he has never conducts,
mm-hmm.
but I made a videotape showing him how to move,
mm.
and so he will get in front of the orchestra, and the orchestra will keep playing whatever he does.
Right. Yeah, they are trained to play the
right.
part, and they know what they're
yeah.
doing.
So to identify hold, maybe Ottavio should stay a surgeon, or whatever his field is.
So, do you have any other things to talk about?
No.
Well, my one question for you is, what would you like to see, having spent 35 years with Greater Bridgeport Symphony, how would you like to see the future of the symphony to go?
I'd like for them to have more concerts, mm-hmm. and to choose a good conductor, a really good conductor.
Mm-hmm.
And do maybe more pop concerts, do mm-hmm. more live music, do more educational concerts. And maybe somebody who could live here, and you couldn't make a living, so that's a problem. You know, most conductors like myself, with Lansing and Bridgeport together, even that would be difficult to make a decent living, a really good living, without academia involved. Mm. But many conductors now have three orchestras, so you have to choose one place or another. Mm-hmm. But they make now new arrangements so that you in the contract, they specify that you have to spend maybe 3 weeks without doing anything, just come to the town and mm-hmm. be reached around socially. So, but I could see someone coming here who would maybe have more time mm-hmm. and could go in the schools more and could give his own parties and invite people and go to schools as a speaker maybe, and although I have done that too, but. Now the important thing here is we have Bob Genualdi is retiring from the youth orchestra, and I think they have hired a woman, I don't know, maybe it's a secret. So that's great. So that's the audience, you know, the children who play in the orchestra, and they go into other fields afterwards, and they throw their violin away. Mm-hmm. And then, but they love, they love still the memory of the time mm-hmm. when they played in the orchestra and had friends, and then they come to the symphony.
Right. Yeah.
But that's why school programs are so essential. I mean, we got to get the youth, we got to get the children.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think they are working on it. And what I like to see is the town grow, and I don't know whether the Palace Theater could ever be opened. Mm-hmm. You know, those two theaters.
Right. It's interesting in the history of the city. Where the Klein Auditorium is was a big fight. Before it was even built, when the money was given to build an auditorium, people wanted it downtown, closer to the downtown area, so that it would be closer to where restaurants and things were.
Right.
They chose where it is, which has been a problem in many ways, because it's sort of not
downtown.
Downtown, and it has its own problems because of that. In other ways, I mean, you have parking, which is good
yeah,
now.
Right, yeah, right. It's better,
working,
yeah.
You know. But,
I'd love to see, I went in there actually. We were shown
to the palace,
palace,
the old
yeah,
theater?
Yeah.
You would like to have it in the.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, it's probably too late now. I think it's. Although they. To walk in there, they had dogs in there to protect the. Smelly, it was just awful, but I could see that there must have been great.
It was never built for a symphony though.
No.
Which,
but
I think
doesn't matter.
Orchestra Hall in Detroit was built, I think, as a
hall for symphony. Well, in Michigan has the same thing. They have a theater which was for vaudeville,
mm-hmm.
and had an organ and had
mm-hmm.
a pit for a big
right,
orchestra.
Right, yeah.
And the symphony, an Arbor Symphony, plays in there.
Oh, do they?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know they played there.
Yeah, and they're very happy about playing there. Come in!
Well, is there anything else you want to mention to
no,
the future? This is actually going to be in the local history collection. It'll be on our collection for posterity.
Uh-huh.
Documentation.
Okay. Or you write out something or some
mm-hmm. We'll be transcribing it.
Yeah.
So and we may end up putting it on the web. We have a website called Bridgeport History.
And you may edit it a
little
bit too, right?
Well, we don't really edit oral histories.
I think you should.
Everything you said was fun.
Yeah.
All righty, thank you so much for
welcome.
Doing it.
It's great.